Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, crew, welcome back to the show. We've got a... I think I mentioned in the last episode I wanted to do one on privacy, but the Bitcoin OpTech newsletter, I think I did the first newsletter from them, where they introduced and kind of talked about what the project was. But I've been reading and keeping up with that one pretty regularly, but it's really technical, usually. It never seemed to be a good one to read on the podcast. Unless I was just kind of hitting bullet points for changes they were making or, you know, commits that I thought were important, like the one about the CVE bug that we had recently is probably a good one maybe to reference for our discussion of that, that I hope to get into soon. But they just had one. This is newsletter 16, I believe. I've got it open right here. Yes, number 16. And it is a Scaling Bitcoin special. And they just had Scaling Bitcoin 5 in Tokyo. And this is basically a rundown of a lot of the topics and different technologies that were discussed during the Scaling Bitcoin conference. So we are going to jump into this one, and I might get back to the one I had on privacy later in the week, and we'll go from there, because this one's really cool, and I think there's some really fun stuff to talk about. All right, so this is from BitcoinOps.org, and this is the Bitcoin OpTech newsletter that we talked about in a previous episode. If you are not following this, it's a completely free newsletter. It is basically just... Their initiative is that they're trying to get businesses and Bitcoin services to adopt all the most efficient and optimized Bitcoin upgrades, and just basically holding their hand through this. And they're not this a completely open, free service and consultancy, essentially. So they are a wonderful, wonderful thing to be following. Again, that's Bitcoin OpTech at BitcoinOps.org. Definitely check them out if you are not following them, because their newsletters are really awesome if you like to dive into the technical stuff. And I probably won't be able to read it because it's so dry. It probably won't be something that I'll do on the podcast a whole lot. All right, without further ado, let's hit Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 16, Scaling Bitcoin Special. This week's newsletter consists entirely of summaries of several notable talks presented at the Scaling Bitcoin workshop last weekend. Since there was very little to report in our usual action items, news, and notable code changes sections, we hope to return to our usual format next week. Workshop summary: Scaling Bitcoin 5, Tokyo 2018. The fifth Scaling Bitcoin conference was held Saturday and Sunday in Tokyo, Japan. In the sections below, we provide brief overviews to some of the talks we think might be most interesting to this newsletter's readers, but we also recommend watching the complete set of videos, link, provided by the workshop organizers, or reading the transcripts, link, provided by Brian Bishop. For convenience, at the end of each summary, we directly link to its video and transcript, and paper if available. Talks are listed below in the order they appeared in the workshop schedule. Warning: the following summaries may contain errors due to many of the talks describing subjects well beyond the expertise of the summary author. Adjusting Bitcoin's Block Subsidy. Research by Anthony A.J. Towns. This talk makes an intellectual inquiry into whether Bitcoin pays more for security than it needs to, and what we could do if we decided it does pay too much. The speaker makes clear that he's interested in considering the questions and providing possible answers, but that he's neither suggesting that there's a problem nor advocating for any solution. If the Bitcoin user base did think it was overpaying for security, the talk suggests options for reducing the amount of subsidy paid in the short term as the amount of security increases, but still ensuring that no more than 21 million Bitcoins are paid overall in subsidy, potentially allowing the subsidy to last much longer than currently expected. Although the talk was not about a specific proposal, an example proposal it evaluated was to reduce the subsidy by 20% every time the network's proof-of-work security doubles, measured by block creation difficulty. Video and transcript. Forward blocks. On-chain capacity increases without a hard fork. Research by Mark Friedenbach. One well-known method for soft forking an increase in the Bitcoin block size is extension blocks, a data structure that's invisible to nodes that haven't upgraded to the soft fork and so is not subject to their historic limits on block size. By itself, this is an undesirable method for increasing block size because preventing old nodes from seeing the transactions in the extension block also prevents them from being able to enforce any other consensus rules on those transactions, such as rules that prevent a malicious user from spending other users' bitcoins or from creating more bitcoins than allowed by the 21 million bitcoin subsidy schedule. However, one doesn't need to increase block size to increase the amount of data that can be added to the blockchain per minute. It's also possible to increase capacity by increasing the frequency of blocks, reducing the average time between blocks. A method for gaming Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment algorithm, called a time warp attack, is well known among experts and has been used successfully in demonstration attacks against Bitcoin's testnet and real attacks against altcoins. Note, although Bitcoin is technically vulnerable to this attack, it would be a slow attack that would give the user base a significant amount of time to respond. By itself, increasing block frequency is also an undesirable method for increasing capacity because shorter block intervals increase the effectiveness of miners with large amounts of hash rate, and so is likely to increase mining centralization. Perhaps disproving the saying that two wrongs don't make a right, this talk describes a novel way of combining extension blocks and the time warp attack to allow both upgraded nodes and old nodes to gain the same capacity increase and see all the same transactions for validation, while simultaneously slightly reducing mining centralization risk. Upgraded nodes would validate one or more extension blocks, called forward blocks, that provide additional block space with a centralization-reducing 15-minute average interval. But the upgraded nodes would also restrict the timestamps in legacy blocks to ensure a permanent, but limited, time warp attack, increase the frequency of legacy blocks enough to allow them to include the same transactions that previously appeared in the forward blocks. Video, transcript, and paper. Compact multi-signatures for smaller blockchains. Research by Dan Benet, Manu Drivers, and Gregory Nevin. This talk describes an alternative to the Schnorr signature scheme described in the MuSig paper that makes use of pairing-based cryptography, specifically an adaptation of the Bona-Lin-Shockham, or BLS, signature scheme. Although pairing-based schemes require an additional fundamental security assumption beyond those made by both Bitcoin's current ECDSA scheme and proposed Schnorr scheme, the authors present evidence that their scheme would produce smaller signatures in general, allowing non-interactive signature aggregation, and make it possible to prove which members of the set of signers actually worked together to create a threshold signature. In other words, K of M signers, for example, 2 of 3, multisig. Video, transcript, and paper. Accumulators, a scalable drop-in replacement for Merkle trees. Research by Benedict Bunce, Benjamin Fish, and Dan Benet. In Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, scalable commitments to sets of information, such as transactions or UTXOs, are normally made using Merkle trees that allow proving an element is a member of the set by generating a proof whose size and validation cost is roughly log 2n for a set of n elements. This talk describes an alternative method based on RSA accumulators that provides potential benefits. The size of a proof is constant, no matter how many elements are members of the set, and adding or removing elements from an accumulator can be efficiently batched. For example, one update per block. Video and transcript. Multi-party ECDSA for scriptless Lightning Network payment channels. Research by Connor Fromnecht. Routable payment channels, such as those used by Lightning Network, currently use multiple opcodes from the script language that are enforced by Bitcoin's consensus rules. Previous work on scriptless scripts by Andrew Palestra has suggested that some or all of the opcodes currently used could be replaced by Schnorr public keys and signatures that would be created privately or off-chain between the participants in the payment channel. Consensus rules would still require that a spending transaction have a valid signature that referenced a known public key, but none of the other security-related information would appear on-chain, reducing data consumption and fees, improving privacy and fungibility, and potentially improving security. Bitcoin doesn't currently support Schnorr signatures, and no complete design for it has been proposed, although such a proposal may not be far off. So this talk describes proof-of-concept results from a partial implementation of payment channel scriptless scripts that's compatible with Bitcoin's current ECDSA keys and signatures. Some impressive savings are achieved in the size of scripts and witness data. Savings which increase the number of channels that can be opened or closed in a block, and which reduces the amount of transaction fee paid by users of Lightning Network payment channels. Video and transcript. Discussion: The evolution of Bitcoin script. A two-hour discussion group focused on this topic mentioned a large variety of proposed changes to Bitcoin's script language. Far too many to mention here, even in summary. However, a few changes were mentioned as theoretically possible to accomplish in 2019 if the community is willing to adopt them. Schnorr signature scheme. An opt-in feature providing smaller signatures in all cases, faster validation, much smaller public key and signature data for cooperative multi-sigs, and easier compatibility with scriptless scripts. See Peter Weller's proposed BIP. SigHash no input unsafe. The ability to create spins without explicitly referencing which output you want to spend allows creating more efficient payment channels using the L2 protocol that also makes it easy for each channel to support up to 150 participants. See BIP 118. OP check sig from stack. Makes it possible to create covenants that restrict what outputs a particular coin can be spent to. For example, you could put a mandatory timeout of 1 week on spins from your cold wallet. During the timeout, you could only spend the coins back into your cold wallet. But if you waited for the timeout to expire, you could spend the coins to an arbitrary address. This means that if someone stole a copy of your cold wallet's private key, you could use this mechanism to prevent them from spending your bitcoins by returning them to your cold wallet during the timeout period. It was noted that some developers are opposed to enabling the simplest form of this opcode for fungibility reasons, although alternative approaches may be more acceptable. Fixing the time warp bug. A set of miners controlling a majority of the hash rate can currently manipulate Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment algorithm to allow them to consistently create more than one block every 10 minutes, even without increasing overall hash rate. there's at least one simple proposal to reduce the amount of manipulation possible without breaking older software or mining equipment. See the recent email thread on the Bitcoin Dev mailing list. And explicit fees. Currently, fees in Bitcoin are implied by the difference between the value of the aggregated inputs and the aggregated outputs. However, the transaction could alternatively explicitly commit to the fee and allow one of the outputs to be set to the difference between the value of the aggregated inputs and the explicit fee plus all the other inputs. This could be useful for rewarding Lightning Network watchtowers that send breach remedy transactions on behalf of offline users, or it could be useful for fee bumping group transactions. However, one member of the discussion group suggested that, quote, the only people who have comfort with soft forks are unlikely to propose a soft fork and produce software that would be adopted. People are going to fight anything that adds anything, especially considering the recent CVE. People are going to be, for the next 6 months, significantly more conservative. It's going to be another 6 months before people are even thinking about it. I don't think we're going to get any new soft forks in the next year. Transcript. Special thanks. We thank Andrew Palestra, Anthony Towns, Brian Bishop, and Peter Wella for providing suggestions or answering questions related to the content of this newsletter. Any remaining errors are entirely the fault of the newsletter's author. All right, so there we have it. That was Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 16, and that was released yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. That's funny. It says October 9th, but it was definitely last night. So maybe this was released in Tokyo, and it was already tomorrow, or it was already today. Okay, well, there is a lot to unpack in this one, and one thing, don't forget to go to bitcoinops.org to check this out, because like he said, and I noted at the end of each section, there's a video and transcript and or research paper for a lot of these, or pretty much every one of them except for one that doesn't have a video. And I definitely encourage you, if you're like trying to do some other stuff and you want some just Bitcoin awesomeness in the background, these are great videos to have playing in the background. And there is one video that I've had on, I think I'm still early in it. I'm listening to a talk by Nick Carter, I think, actually is the one that is on. Where's my tab? Oh God, I have so many tabs. This is a problem. It's like 8.5 hours or something from this conference, if I'm not mistaken. I think, I don't know, there's so much Bitcoin stuff going on right now, and I just like to have a lot of it on in the background to just soak it up piece by piece by osmosis and passive listening every once in a while. So the first thing, adjusting Bitcoin's block subsidy. That's a really fun discussion. I've done a lot of thinking about this. There are a couple of articles and little things out there talking about soft forking the block subsidy down. There was a really good, I think it was just a discussion on Twitter and, maybe it was the Bitcoin Talk forums or something, about leveling out the subsidy, like creating a per block down slope of the subsidy. So rather than the 12.5 for 210,000 blocks, and then 6.25 for 210,000 blocks, you have 12.5 for the first block, 12.49999 for the next block, 12.4998, so on and so forth for the entire period. So there's never actually these huge drops in the or halvings in the block subsidy. And there's a lot of really fun discussion and stuff around that. But while I think, and I'll probably listen to this video actually just to see what Anthony Towns has to say about, because I have not listened to that one specifically yet. And I like the idea. It seems like a good discussion to have, particularly about when the proof of work security doubles, because if they were reducing the subsidy during those periods, what it would do is it would essentially react to giant price swings to ensure that even though they're only the same, roughly the same amount of transactions, and you know, not a lot of the underlying nature of the chain has, or economic activity has changed, we're subsidizing vastly, vastly more computing power to achieve the security. But I think that's kind of a false equivalency, maybe, because if we're talking about the fact that the price has 10x'd and then the hash rate security, you know, does a 10x or 20x at the exact same time, well, we're talking about a network that is securing economic transactions with vastly more value in them. So, you know, if you're paying 100x or you're securing every one Bitcoin transaction with 100x of the hash rate, but your Bitcoin is worth 100x what it was from 3 years ago, well, that kind of makes sense. You know, like if you're holding more economic value on the chain, what is that? I think there was somebody posted on Twitter not too long ago about it being like a 4.9%, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't save it. And even if I did save it, I saved so much stuff, it just gets lost in the things that I saved. But it was like, I think that was what it was saying. It was 4.9% is being paid to in the subsidy on average to secure the amount transacted. And which is a really interesting, like I said, it's a really interesting discussion, but I think that's all it is just a discussion. So that would be really fun to listen to, but I don't see any way that there's even going to be a soft fork. I don't think there's any real need for it. It's not like this a pressing matter at all. So really fun to talk about, not really applicable, and I don't see any reason that there would ever be a official proposal that actually made it happen. All right, forward blocks, on-chain capacity increases without a hard fork. This is both a really interesting and kind of scary proposal because of it. The explanation was a little bit hard to follow, but it makes sense that this would be possible, that the upgraded nodes would validate an extension block, one or more extension blocks referred to as a forward block, that would provide additional block space. And it says here, with a centralization reducing 15-minute average interval. I don't quite get what that's getting at, that it's centralization reducing. Maybe it's just that because it's got a larger time for propagating, but you're still propagating the 10-minute blocks at the same time. So I don't quite see how that changes things. I guess since the nodes that are mining and validating forward blocks have more time to deal with the extension blocks. But using the time warp trick, because you can manipulate your timestamps on legacy blocks, that you could continue to have all these same transactions linked to a normal legacy block, and all those nodes would think that they're coming in at 10-minute intervals, but what they're actually doing is squeezing that 10 minutes using fake timestamps. And by jointly using fake timestamps for all the soft fork miners that are agreeing to cheat this timestamp, and legacy blocks think, oh, it's been, you know, 10 minutes since the last block on average, when in fact it's been 7 minutes since the last block, and we squeezed another block in there on average every 15 minutes. But I don't like that idea. I mean, it's a really cool concept. I think this is the one, Mark Friedenbach, I think this is the one that got some, a little bit of heated discussion on Twitter when I saw it, somebody propose it, and a number of the core devs came back because it sounded like, I mean, in a sense, this is technically an attack. This is gaming a vulnerability in the difficulty adjustment, because the 10-minute intervals have to rely on timestamps from miners. And we've seen what an attack of that nature looks like on Verge with Daniel Goldman's articles on Let's Do the Time Warp and or Let's Do the Time Warp Again, and the two huge attacks on Verge and a number of other little altcoins that have been hit with it, causing, you know, block intervals to go all over the place. But again, this is a really interesting use of the time warp vulnerability. But it's funny, there's a proposal for or the discussion of a soft fork that could add forward blocks by agreeing to basically abuse this vulnerability. And then at the same time, we've got a discussion down at the end of how to fix the time warp attack. So these are obviously mutually exclusive proposals, and doing one or the other eliminates the other being a reasonable possibility. But again, I don't see, maybe we'll get to a point where extension blocks or forward blocks are desirable. I honestly don't think so, but I think it makes more sense to do an explicit extension block and leave out a time warp vulnerability, even though it's a less secure transition, in the sense that anybody running an old node would not be able to validate these transactions. Is if you put it on a 4-year time scale and, you know, required 95% of nodes and or miners and all that good stuff, or, you know, 98%, whatever it is, I think you can mitigate a lot of that by heavily preparing for any change like that. But I honestly question whether or not that's even needed. I think we've proven again and again that block space is just not a huge concern in how these things operate, and there would be 1,000 altcoins with a higher price than Bitcoin if on-chain transactions really were the deciding factor, and they just aren't. I think it's a dismissal or a dodging of the really important thing that's happening. And I would prefer personally, if somebody made this proposal to abuse the time warp problem in Bitcoin, and then somebody made another proposal to fix the time warp problem, I would absolutely go down on the side of fixing the time warp and making this a non-issue, so that we can go back to making things resource efficient and focusing on things like BLS signatures and Schnorr signatures, which are talked about just a little bit further down in this discussion, which I think are far more impactful and do so many other things alongside of it that extension blocks and or forward blocks are just kind of poor priority or bad optimization choices. Okay, compact multi-signatures for smaller blockchains. So, this is an alternative to the Schnorr signature scheme, and it's an adaptation of the BLS signature scheme. Now, I don't know, I have not read much about BLS. I did read a couple of discussions about it where people were kind of going back and forth. Apparently, both have some serious advantages that are along the same lines. Obviously, aggregating signatures being a huge part of it. And I can't remember which is which, but if I'm not mistaken, I remember the main differences being between computation versus data optimizations. So I think it's like BLS would be, and I don't know which is which, so I'm just pulling this out of my ass, but like one of them is more computationally intensive but requires a little bit less data, or maybe some additional time during certain circumstances, and Schnorr or BLS doesn't. Like there are these mild differences, but supposedly the bulk of the security assumptions are the same. But this states that the pairing-based schemes require an additional fundamental security assumption beyond those made with ECDSA and Schnorr. So I think that's why Schnorr is kind of seems to be the leading player in this, is that the security assumptions are very, very similar, if not the same. but I don't know exactly the difference between the, because this one specifically talks about being able to do non-interactive signature aggregation. So that's actually a really, non-interactive is so important. Everything that I've read about the non-interactive, I mean, it means that you don't have to talk to the other players involved to aggregate signatures, which is a huge deal. And if I'm not mistaken, Schnorr is that way as well, Musig. I may be wrong on that, so I don't want to commit to that, but I would be very disappointed if Schnorr was not. I have to read a little bit more into that. But regardless, both of these are huge, really big changes that make efficiency, signature aggregation, and data cost wildly, wildly improved, which is why I'm so excited about all of them. I've been far more in the reading about Schnorr and stuff, but I've heard a lot of good things about BLS, so I don't really know which way the wind is going to blow. Obviously, we do have a BIP from Peter Wella, so it may just be the amount of work that is already done with that, and then subsequently testing for other things with Schnorr. So it might have the benefit of people already working and kind of building layers with what we can do with Schnorr that kind of puts it a little bit ahead of BLS. But unfortunately, this summary doesn't really give many details at all. So I probably am going to dive into the video. Didn't mean to play it. Dive into the video and let that go in the background today and see what I can find. It's about an hour and 25 minutes. So, all right, then accumulators, scalable drop-in replacement for Merkle trees. I do not know much about this, but it sounds cool. So the whole idea of Merkle trees is a proof that's a log of the size of the number of elements used in the tree, which is amazing, but the fact that these supposed RSA accumulators can have a constant proof size is pretty amazing. And the fact that they can be batched, in this example, they said once per block, that sounds like a major breakthrough. I am going to listen to the video there as well, but I have to admit, I don't really know if the proposals we already have for Merkle trees, aside from the difference specifically stated of the log 2n versus just a constant proof size, which that just sounds, that's amazing. That's a huge, huge difference when we're talking about large sets of players. And it also, I'm also unsure of the difference of the size of the proof for a small number of players versus a large. So maybe this constant proof is bigger when we're talking up to, you know, 20 participants or 20, a set of 20. And then after that, the log 2n of the other proofs is larger and larger and larger, and it passes the constant proof that we're talking about in these RSA accumulators. But I don't have any clue. I mean, we just read two paragraphs on it. So maybe if you got another video to watch, and a lot of these things to just play on in the background. You know, it's hard to listen to a video and read something at the same time, I have learned. I have tried. It doesn't work. I don't recommend it. In multi-party ECDSA for scriptless Lightning payment channels. That is awesome. I have been really excited about scriptless scripts and the idea of just creating public keys from a set of scripts and signatures is just awesome. It makes everything public and private key, and you're basically taking your private key and turning it into making your set of signatures with whoever you're making an agreement with, and turning it into a public key that doesn't say anything about what's behind it. In the same way that a public key doesn't say anything about the private key, you can't reverse it. You're making a public key based from the private key, the multiple signatures that were involved, the scripts, the four scripts that were involved. Because, I mean, Lightning Network has a lot of scripts in it. We've gone through the commitment transactions and how many different alternatives. It's got three different branches with two different options for each branch, I think. There's one, two. I don't know, but it's a big set of scripts in a real sense. And that's a lot of data. And the fact that you could just remove all of that, hide it behind a single public key that was a combination of each one of those, and then just make it look like any other transaction, that's just fascinating. And apparently this is by a Schnorr public key. So this would require Schnorr, and I think scriptless scripts just in general does as well. So again, that's one of those situations where I think maybe because so much work and discussion has happened on Schnorr that it's a little bit ahead of the game on BLS, or at least from my perspective, I have not read or seen nearly as much about BLS as I have with Schnorr. So that'll be interesting to kind of see which one takes the cake or which one has a feature or ability that others that the other doesn't, that kind of puts it out as the key player moving forward. Because I really hope we get at least one of these into the protocol, because it would be such a huge advancement for features, more complex scripts, and then obviously a optimization of data costs and resources and privacy. Fungibility between anything with crazy complex scripts and Merkle trees that looks almost identical to a single input-to-output style transaction. So, yes, that is a whole lot of stuff, and holy crap, I have rambled for a while. So this is a really long episode, but there was a lot to break down, and I definitely encourage you to go check out bitcoinops.org. Check out this newsletter. Check out all their newsletters if you're trying to dig into the technicals of this stuff. It's a really, really great place to do it and get a reliable discussion and breakdowns of what's going on in the Bitcoin protocol and commits, and also within the space, like, you know, upgrading SegWit and all the new improvements that we do have that are slowly being rolled out. And obviously, they've got links to the videos and transcripts of all this stuff. So if you want to sit down and listen to all this mess like I do, go check it out. Okay, guys. That will close our episode for today. I think, does Bitcoin Ops have a Twitter account? I bet they do. Let's see. We got John Newberry, James O'Byrne, Steve Lee, David A. Harding, Marcin Jakmiak. I don't know how to say that name. Where is... Aha, Bitcoin Op Tech. Okay, at Bitcoin Op Tech. That's just the Twitter handle. So I will link to that one. And, of course, the page itself in the show notes and the Twitter post, so everybody can go check it out and listen to all those videos and subscribe to the Bitcoin Op Tech newsletter, and you'll get it in your mail, in your email, so you stay up to date on all this cool stuff. All right, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. And if you would like to support the show, I would really appreciate any donations. It's a huge, huge help. It keeps my coffee mug full so I can listen to all these videos and read all these things and bring the best stuff to you in audio format. And if you're getting value out of this, if you can share it, if you'd like to donate, that's awesome as well. Leave me a review. Anything, all those things are great ways to help out the show. And of course, if you have not gotten your Bitcoin Trezor wallet, do it through my affiliate link. You'll send a couple of bucks to me. It won't cost you anything different, but you'll be helping out the Crypto Economy podcast. All right, guys. Lastly, don't forget to check out cryptoeconomy.life. If you want to get up with me, that is the easiest way to do so. I am up there literally every day now trying to keep up with the website and trying to make a platform to discuss things with my listeners in a reliable way that is not dependent on Twitter, since it can be pretty unreliable at times. Okay, that'll be it. Follow me on Twitter, Mastodon, and Medium, and check out the website, cryptoeconomy.life. And I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.
We'll be right back.